For a long while they sang only each alone, all but few together, while the rest hearkened. Each comprehended only that part of the mind of Ilúvatar from which he came, and in the understanding of their brethren they grew but slowly. Yet ever as they listened, they came to a deeper understanding, and increased in unison and harmony.
Welcome to Lore of the Rings, a sub-creation of the Card Game Cooperative and Critical Encounters podcast. On these shows, we will be delving deeply into the lore of the cards and into the story being told to and by the players through the various quests and scenarios. So come, pull up a chair, smoke a pipe. In this hall, you will hear many songs and tales, if you can keep awake.
Well, hello. Hi, guys. How's it going?
Good, thank you.
Good evening or afternoon. Not going too badly, thanks. How are you doing?
Good, good. I'm glad that we're back recording. Excited to do some Lord of the Rings again.
It has indeed been a while.
And we've got a quest that has a bit of interest, some intrigue.
And which quest is that, Simon?
The quest that we're covering today is Journey Along the Anduin, the second quest from the Lord of the Rings, the card game core box.
It's definitely a long, yeah? Definitely not Journey Down the Anduin.
No, this one's a long.
Yeah. The newer one is Up the Anduin, but it wasn't Down the Anduin.
Carry on up the Anduin.
That would be a very different quest, I feel. So, should we have a bit of a kind of historical recap? Just remind ourselves when we are. So,
yeah.
When the game first came out, we were looking. We were told that we were in the 17 years between Bilbo's 11th birthday and when Frodo leaves the Shire in Third Age 3018. So. About 60 years after the events of The Hobbit. And tonight we're going to be focusing on life in the Anduin Valley. So, Steve, do you want to run us through some kind of important events from the history of the Anduin River?
Sure. So, like you said, Anduin River Valley life, right? So a few of the important things. We're just going to start in the Third Age. Year 2 in the Third Age is when Isildur swims the Anduin to escape the disasters at the Gladden Fields, and he loses the One Ring to the Anduin. 1050 is when the Shadow calls on Greenwood and men rename it Mirkwood. So that's when it goes from a nicer place to a little creepier. 1357, the Stores, which are a type of hobbit, settle in the Gladden Fields and become the Riverland people. About 500 years later, the Northmen, defeated by the Wainriders, fled the Battle of the Plain, and some come to the Anduin Valley. They settle here. Dwellings in the vales of the Anduin between the Kerak and the Gladden Fields take shape, and these would eventually become the Eothred, who would become the Rohirrim. So we jump ahead. 2463 in the Third Age, Deagle finds the One Ring in the Anduin. And Smeagol takes it from him, sort of violently.
I love that. Just violently.
Violently. Yeah. So that ring is like in the lost for, 2,461 years or something like that. So
just chilling in the Anduin.
Yeah. 7 years later, Gollum retreats and hides in the Misty Mountains. 2851. Saruman now begins searching the Gladden Fields for the One Ring. And then 2939, some years later, Sauron begins searching the Gladden Fields for the One Ring. So it takes them a while to locate it. But it's not there, or to at least go looking for it, because Smeagol has it.
That's probably why they were looking for it so long. If it had been there, you would imagine they would have found it in less than 150 years.
So that's sort of like a bunch of important things that happen in and around the river. In the Third Age. But we have a fun little quest here. Let's take a look at the quest card so we know what we're doing here along the Anduin.
I can do that. So as folks may remember, the first quest has you traveling through Mirkwood with a message from Lord Elrond for Lady Galadriel. And it's where that quest finishes that this one picks up. So it says, emerging from Mirkwood Forest with an urgent message for Lady Galadriel, you must now make your way south along the Anduin River in order to reach the Forest of Lorien. As you leave the forest behind, you notice you're being pursued, and thus quicken your pace. As you approach the location of a small raft stashed on the riverbank, a fearsome hill troll emerges from behind a grouping of rocks and attacks. So yeah, this you kind of start off with just everyone reveal a card and add it to the staging area, and you think, okay, that's not too bad a setup, and you flip to side B. Oh, and search for a hill troll if you haven't found one already. And yeah, you can't advance from stage one until the hill troll has been defeated.
See, I do think that that's like a nice little caveat if one is not already in play.
Because there are two in the deck.
Yeah, best case scenario here is that you get one during that when everyone draws one encounter card. Worst case situation here is that you're playing as two players and both of the cards are hill trolls.
Oh, yeah. That'd be tough. I don't know if I've ever had that happen.
Or both of the cards are goblin snipers, and then you have to reveal a hill troll.
Okay, yep, you're right. It could be worse.
Yeah. But either way, yeah, you've got that first stage. It doesn't require a lot of progress. It does require you to kill the hill troll. And then you move on to stage two, the Anduin Passage. After defeating the troll, you're able to board the raft and embark upon a river voyage. As you depart, your enemies pursue, harassing the small vessel as you attempt to navigate the river. As your enemies harass the raft, it is difficult to maintain balance and effectively fight them off. So you're revealing an extra encounter card from the deck each phase. You don't make engagement checks during the encounter phase. You can still optionally engage one thing. So, again, depending on player count and luck, the enemies can rack up in the staging area as you sail down the river on the raft.
I think that is like a really fun theme right there. Right, you can just keep rowing down the river, take that raft and just kind of let them go on the banks, or you'd have to kind of steer your raft to the side, or maybe you're shooting at them. I just it's a nice, it feels really like a nice theme hit there. I like that one.
It adds in like a nice little bit of jeopardy as well. Like, you could spend your time on this quest stage and try and build up and, you know, bolster your raft with additional people that you've dragged out the water along the way, or some equipment that you've found on a rock. You then risk ending up with all of these things on the banks waiting for you.
Well, let's see what happens when we finally dock the raft in stage three, ambush on the shore. The ongoing harassment from your enemies has forced your raft to the shore, and you must now confront their ambush head-on. If you survive this attack, the path to the Golden Wood should be open before you. So stage three has zero progress required. However, when revealed, reveal two encounter cards per player and add them to the staging area. Skip the staging step at the quest phase for the remainder of the game. So you still quest, you just don't reveal cards. But you, in from a threat perspective, you're still questing. And it says, once there are no enemies in play, the players have won the game. So yeah, you've potentially got a big build up from stage two. Then you get another two cards per player for starting stage three. And then that's it for the game. So generally, if you can survive that round and maybe the round after, it tends to be fairly manageable after that point. But yeah, that depending on how you've approached stage two, the flip of stage three can be a big punch in the teeth.
Yeah. It's kind of funny. You're on this raft and you're going down the Anduin and these guys are running along the shore and somehow they beat you to it because you have to punch through them in order to make it to where you're going. So that's like one of a, it's weird. They're really fast. So.
And the more of them that there are on the shore, the slower you move down the river. Oh yeah, because I think I forgot to say there's 16 progress you need for stage two. So particularly in solo, revealing two cards a round, that's quite a lot of progress to put together.
Yeah, especially with one additional encounter card every phase. Still, it feels, I think the quest has a nice feel to it, you know. It feels like you're trying to outrun them and then you have to deal with them at the end when you finally pull off to the shore.
The thing I've always really wanted to do with this quest, and I've never quite got there, is to spend enough time building up on stage two that by the time you get to stage three, you've got like two or three Gondorian spearmen out, ideally with Spears of the Citadel on them, plus one on Beragund. And you then have in hand light the beacons and stand together. I assume people remember Stand Together, which is just defend with any number of characters you like. In case you don't remember it, light the beacons is a five-cost spirit event. Until the end of the round, all characters get +2 defense and do not exhaust to defend. So you can just defend with all the defenders at once and do 6 damage to each enemy as it attacks.
So you get on the raft just barely with, like, you know, just a couple guys. By the time you get off the raft, you have a phalanx of Gondorian army who somehow joined you on the raft.
I assume that they were probably airdropped in by the Eagles.
Right.
So much theme.
Yeah.
I mean, about as much theme as the third Hobbit film.
Touché. So, I don't know about you guys, but I find that with this quest, I either win it really convincingly or lose magnificently. I never feel like there's a... Oh, I just made that. It's either, wow, I can't believe that I've ever found that quest difficult, or why can't I beat this sodding quest?
Yeah, I don't think I tend to lose this one on stage 3. I think if I get as far as stage 3, then things tend to be fine. It's more if things go badly on stage 1, or maybe if you get overwhelmed by threat in the staging area on stage 2.
Yeah, you get pounded into the ground by that troll right away, and you know it's over. Or, you just can't quest in 2. You can get, like, location locked with so many the extra encounter cards, which is interesting. They get location locked as you're floating down the river. So,
should we kind of take a bit of a look at some of the specific cards and then maybe circle back to overall impressions of the quest once we've talked about the individual bits? I think that might be bit easier for people to follow.
Yeah, I think that sounds good. Well, I did a bunch of research on the locations and some theme for them, kind of like our last show. Let me tell you about some of the key locations. I picked out 4 that I think are worth talking about.
Go for it.
I'm going to start with the non-river locations, actually. So we'll talk about the Brownlands, which is a 5-threat, 1-progress wasteland card. And it has an interesting force. After you travel to it, you put a progress there. So it just sort of takes care of itself. But what are the Brownlands? So if you go into the Fellowship of the Ring, Book 2 in Chapter 9, we get a nice explanation from Tolkien. It says, on the eastern banks to their left, they saw long, formless slopes stretching up and away towards the sky. Brown and withered they looked, as if fire had passed over them, leaving no living blade of green. An unfriendly waste without even a broken tree or bald stone to relieve the emptiness. They had come to the Brownlands that lay vast and desolate between southern Mirkwood and the hills of the Emyn Muil. What pestilence or war or evil deed of the enemy had so blasted all that region, even Aragorn could not tell. The Brownlands rose into bleak wolds over which flowed a chill air from the east. On the other side, the meads had become rolling down of withered grass amidst a land of fen and tussock. So the Brownland is just this bleak wasteland, totally exposed. It's very much like the picture, I think, of the art. It's just this, you know, it's brown and nothing else is there. But I guess the threat of it, of what could be there, is what we're seeing in the game.
Yeah. When you consider how fantastic some of the art in this game is, the Brownlands is basically just a kind of brown smear with a grubby sky.
Yeah, they're very threatening but easily explored, since there's like nowhere to hide on the Brownlands. But there's another interesting piece of lore about the Brownlands that we learned from Treebeard. He talks about them at one point, and it says, when the darkness came in the north, the Entwives crossed the great river and made new gardens and tilled new fields, and we saw them more seldom. After the darkness was overthrown, and the lands of the Entwives blossomed richly, and their fields were full of corn, many men learned the crafts of the Entwives and honored them greatly. But we were only a legend to them, a secret in the heart of the forest. Yet here we still are, while all the gardens of the Entwives are wasted, and men call them the Brownlands now. That's kind of interesting to think that this land was once like gardens of the Entwives, and, you know, but they're all been destroyed. So it's a little more oblique to think about that land there.
It doesn't bode well for the Entwives still being out there somewhere, and they just can't find them.
Yeah, no, it does not. So that's the Brownlands. You're gonna see that card plenty. There's another wasteland location that we get called the East Bight. And this is sort of a reverse. It's a one threat, six progress. So it's like a flip from the Brownlands. And when faced with the option to travel here, you have to. It's a little interesting. So let me tell you about the East Bight, and then I want to come back to that mechanic on the card. So this is from Unfinished Tales, which is maybe not official canon, but it's still important in Tolkien's Legendarium, I think. So the Othred were first known by that name in the days of King Celementar of Gondor, who died in the year 1936 of the Third Age, at which time they were a small people living in the vales of Anduin between the Kerak and the Gladden Fields, for the most part on the west side of the river. They were a remnant of the Northmen, who had formerly been a numerous and powerful confederation of peoples living in the wide plains between Mirkwood and the River Running, great breeders of horses and riders renowned for their skill and endurance, though their settled homes were in the eaves of the forests, and especially in the East Bight, which had largely been made by their felling of trees. So the East Bight is that, if you look at the map, there looks like someone took a bite out of Mirkwood on the eastern side, and these men who, you know, someday eventually become the Rohirrim, had cut down all these trees, kind of making this indentation in the forest. They'll refer to it in other places as like the waste of the forest, W-A-I-S-T, you know, like the part of your body where it's thinnest. And the word bight is actually Old English, meaning like bend or angle or corner, often associated with a coastline. And Tolkien's using that term for his forests, kind of referring to them as an ocean or the sea, which he does many times in his writing, which I found very interesting. So we know where it is and who put it there and what it is. It's this wasteland. It's all open space. But it is so far away from the river, which is what throws me for a loop. You have to get out of the river, cross the Vale, go through Mirkwood to end up on the eastern side of Mirkwood. I do not understand how this piece fits in with the theme of this adventure, where you're going down the river on a raft, but you're going to get out and you're going to travel 100 some miles off course. And according to the card, you have to do it. You have to do it. So it's kind of weird.
It's probably closer to the River Running than to the Anduin. Certainly more accessible from that side. So.
I think we mentioned this a little bit in the last episode, and I'm sure it won't be the last time that we mention it. It's certainly not going to be the last time that I mention it. I think there's a few cards in this core set. There could have been more encounter sets, more smaller encounter sets. I think there's some cards in these that suffer from this whole encounter set is vaguely generic.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. I mean, this comes from the set, I don't know, with the little paw print on it, not the river set.
Is it the Wilderlands? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, Creatures of Wilderlands or something, maybe? Yeah. I can't remember the exact name. But no, I agree. It's because they have only three or four modular sets in the core, and they're going to reuse them. And I understand that. It's still like, okay, let's get out of the boat.
Yeah. Go way over there. I know exactly what you mean. It's just they're like, well,
quick.
My immersion!
Quick maths question. If you're revealing two encounter cards, and the first card is the Brownlands, what are the odds that the second one will be the East Bight? 100%. Yeah, they're just such an awful combination. Because yeah, Brownlands, as long as you can travel there, no problem. East Bight, don't care, happily not travel there. Oh great, I've now had to travel there. I'm stuck with the five threat of the Brownlands, and I've got to make six progress on the East Bight before I can travel again.
That's when you draw that second hill troll.
Yes. Yep. All right. Well, okay. So those cards. They're not river areas, but there are two interesting locations that are far more thematic for like, traveling down the river. And let me tell you, the Gladden Fields. So we've heard of the Gladden Fields quite a bit. We talked about it in the timeline, and you know, people know the lore about Isildur and that sort of thing. But did you guys know that there is a plant called a Gladden?
I did not.
Did you know that?
I didn't either. No.
I didn't either. So, the word Gladden The plant has several different spellings, one which matches the Gladden Fields that Tolkien uses. It's a reed-like plant, often called sword lily or little sword. And it can refer to like any plant that has sword-like leaves. So the Gladden Fields is a field with these sword lilies in them. So real tall reeds with long-bladed grass. Sindarin, it's called Leog Nigloron, or the pools of golden water flowers. So it's safe to assume that these sword lilies are also golden in color within Middle-earth. So this place, it's along the shore where the Gladden River empties into the Anduin at a right angle. And the if you take the word angled, becomes an anagram for Gladden. Interestingly enough. I don't know if that has anything to do with that. I just thought that was interesting. Yeah. Back in the Elder Days, this area, there was actually a lake where the two rivers met. But by Isildur's time, we read, the lake has become a great marsh through which the river wandered in a wilderness of islets and wide beds of reed and rush, and armies of yellow Irish that grew taller than a man and gave their name to all the region and to the river from the mountains about whose lower course they grew most thickly. But the marsh had receded to the east, and from the foot of the lower slopes there were now wide flats grown with grass and small rushes which men could walk. So the unfinished tales. So the Gladden Fields is this place where the Gladden River hits the Anduin at a right angle, and there's this marsh and fen there. And it used to stretch almost to the mountains, but it's now been overgrown and kind of filled in. So you can travel between the mountains and the Gladden Fields on foot. So this spot, it's fairly important to the overall story of Lord of the Rings. In the second year of the Third Age, Isildur, with the One Ring and his three sons, set out for Rivendell from Gondor. And on the 30th day of their trek, he's attacked on the northern edges of Gladden Fields by 10 times the number of orcs than Dunedain that he had with him. He sends off some men, the stories sort of conflict on how many of them, with the shards of Narsil, which eventually do reach Rivendell. He doesn't send any other heirlooms, and him and the rest of his men are slain. And there in the dark pools amid the Gladden Fields, said Gandalf, the ring passed out of knowledge and legend, and even so much of its history is known now only to a few, and the Council of the Wise could discover it no more. So this is that spot where the ring goes into the river, River Gladden, not the Anduin, goes into the Gladden, and is lost. So that kind of makes sense. While you're there, according to the card, your threat's going to go up, right? That's what happens if it's the active location. You got to raise your threat. This spot is, Sauron has been watching, Saruman is watching, the enemies are watching, the power of the ring lived here for thousands of years, so it's sort of a dark place. I think that's a pretty good theme, I think, for that location.
No, that seems, yeah, I'd agree with you on that. I'm wondering if also, like, it sounds like this would be a place where it potentially have a lot of open space around it, and you'd be able to be seen a lot easier as well. You know, you're passing through this area that's largely marshland. It's all going to be very low level. So all those things that are out on the banks stalking you, they've got a perfect view of you there in the middle of it on your raft as you're like going, oh no, we're going to have to get off this soon.
Yeah, and I think too, being a marshland, if you pull your raft over, you're going to get stuck in the mud and the reeds.
Yeah.
And it's just easier for the enemies to get to you. Yeah. Now, it does have victory points. So once you've dealt with it, you've dealt with it. So
I feel they were...
There's more than one copy, isn't there? There's three copies.
I feel they were a lot more generous with victory points back in the day.
Early on.
Because, you know, it's a little bit punishing, extra threat. But realistically, a 3-3, you'd hope to be clearing that in a round. So a location that costs you one threat if it becomes active, I don't feel you'd have been getting three victory points for that 2-3 years later.
Yeah, well, and this is when victory points counted towards your overall score, too, when you were keeping score.
I'm still keeping score.
I'm still keeping score.
Okay. I am, too, but not in that same way where I'm tracking points, just if I beat this thing. All right, so there's one more location I think is we have to talk about. And it's just called Banks of the Anduin. It couldn't be named anything more generic, but what is the Anduin River, right? What is the Anduin River? That's a good question for people who, looking at the map, they'll see it go from the very tippy top to the very bottom of the map, right? It's called the Great River. It has its source in the Misty Mountains, where the Langwell River arises, and the Ered Mithrin, or the Grey Mountains, meet where the Greylin arises. So there are two tributaries that meet below the foothills to form the beginning of the Anduin. And from there, it flows south between Mirkwood and the Misty Mountains. It's joined by the Rimdath, or the Rushdown, which drains the eastern slopes of the Misty Mountains. So now you have a third river going into it, which is why this thing will be so large. The river continues past the Kerok, the Old Forest Road. It's joined by the Gladden River, or the Ninglor. The Celebrant River, the Silver Lode, meets the Anduin. That comes down from near Moria and forms the southern border. That river forms the southern border of Lorien. So you have another large river into it. From there, the Great River will wind its way past the fields of Celebrant to receive the Limelight, which drains the northern part of Fangorn Forest, which will define Rohan's northern border. The Anduin flows through the Numenorean-made gates of the Argonath, which are those, you know, giant statues that you can see in the movies. And then it widens to form a lake, the Nenhithlo, and that contains the island of Tol Brandir, and the river then pours over the Ralros Falls. So those falls must be humongous if you consider the amount of rivers leading into the Anduin, how big this river is. After that, it goes down, and the Snowborn from the White Mountains flows into it, and that's southern Rohan. And you also get it water from the Entwash, which comes from the Misty Mountains through Fangorn Forest. So two more rivers from Rohan into it. It goes on past Minas Tirith, and past Minas Tirith you get the Irui. You get the Irui, and that's the easternmost river of Lebanon, which is in the Outlands area of Gondor, which is south of Minas Tirith. So that flows into the Great River. From there, the Cirith, which originates in the White Mountains as well, drains eastern Lebanon and joins the Anduin River at the port of Pelargir, which we'll eventually travel to in the quests. But then the southern, it's not done receiving water from other rivers. The southernmost tributary is the River Poros, which we will also have to cross at some point in the quest. That begins in the Ethel Dueth, which borders Mordor. So this river comprises the southern border of Ithilien and joins the Anduin from the east. And from here, the river will widen out into a very large delta, the Ethier Anduin, or the mouth of the Anduin, and that drains in the Bay of Belfalas. So if you look at the card location, if you clear it, it just goes back on top of the deck, right? Instead of putting it in the discard pile, and it comes back out. Because this river goes on forever.
Yeah,
forever.
I love that.
More banks of the Anduin.
Yeah.
More banks of the Anduin. Sorry.
Yeah, you can travel the length of Middle Earth on this thing.
Can I just interject with a random lore nugget for Tol Brandir?
Yeah.
So, people who have read The Silmarillion might remember the name Brandir. Brandir the Lame was the chieftain of the village where Turin Turambar finds himself near the end of his life, and where he finds himself rescuing and ultimately falling in love with and marrying a hapless amnesiac young maiden who comes fleeing into his village one day, not knowing that she is in fact his younger sister, because he's not seen her in decades and
Spoilers.
She's completely forgotten. There is Turin's final epic confrontation with Glaurung. The great worm is defeated, Turin is dead, and Ninor, the sister, like realizes, because when the dragon dies, the cloud is lifted off her mind, and she hurls herself off of a mighty waterfall, and Brandir, who loved Ninor himself but couldn't have her because she was with Turin, is kind of last seen looking down over the falls into the depths where she has plummeted. So I think it's really interesting that the idea that the elves kind of remembered the story and they went, right, we've got this island that's sat at the top of this epic waterfall that just kind of seems to plummet down into infinity, and yeah, naming it Brandir was an interesting, little echo of the First Age.
That's the stuff Tolkien does so good. It's just, yeah, that's an excellent connection.
Like the amount of people, like, I've read The Silmarillion and Lord of the Rings and never noticed that. And how many people are there that actually know that? Yeah, it's there. And he put that effort into it, probably knowing that that many people would never even know.
Particularly, you know, if you think that when Tolkien was writing, you didn't have obsessive internet fan communities to kind of spot these things and point them out to another thousand people. You'd have to, each person would have to spot that themselves and go, ah.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, I was kind of like paying attention to Tolkien likes his rivers, his big rivers, and there's plenty of them in the first stage. The river that Nienor throws herself into, is that like the Cirenan or something like that, which is also like the major river of the time? And Anduin's the major river, so there might even be more of a connection there. So that's cool. I'd have to look again.
Sort the map later.
Yeah. Well, those are, I think, some of the main, you know, the locations you're going to encounter. But, you know, you're not really just going to see locations. We're going to see some creatures, right?
I think before we do that, just as a quick callback to our last episode and our confusion, worth mentioning that not only have we got the East Bight in here, but we do also have the Necromancer's Pass. So, once again, ending up at the Necromancer's Pass.
Yeah, apparently the Necromancer's Pass, you can go into it from one side and come out the other and be anywhere you want in the middle.
Yeah, yeah, it's like some kind of like pocket universe that you just appear in, like, oh no.
So apparently Nino threw herself into the Taglin, which was a major tributary of the Sirion, not into the Sirion proper.
Okay.
But yeah, so as you say, there are many creatures, and I think there's only really one acceptable place to start when thinking about enemies in Journey Along the Anduin, and that has to be the Hill Troll.
Not the Goblin Sniper?
I mean, as annoying as the Goblin Sniper is, that the Hill Troll is always going to be in play at the start of the quest. Yeah. And this quest, for most people who've ever played this game, is basically learn to care about your starting threat and managing your threat. Because if you don't, there's a Hill Troll coming for you. But yeah, so trolls. Mutton yesterday, mutton today, and blimey if it don't look like mutton again tomorrow. Never a blinking bit of man flesh have we had for long enough, said a second. What the hell William was a-thinking of to bring us into these parts at all beats me. And the drink running short, what's more, he said, jogging the elbow of William, who was taking a pull at his jug. William choked. Shut your mouth, he said, as soon as he could. You can't expect folks to stop here forever just be eaten by you and Bert. You've had a village and a half between you since we come down from the mountains. How much more do you want? Time's been up our way. You'd have said, thank you, Bill, for this nice bit of fat valley mutton like this. What? He took a big bite of a sheep's leg he was toasting and wiped his lips on his sleeve. Yes, I'm afraid the trolls do behave like that, even those with only one head each. So yeah, that's when Bilbo first encounters the trolls in The Hobbit. They are not portrayed as the brightest. As best as we can tell, the trolls were first created by Morgoth towards the end of the First Age. Now, there's a sort of fairly well-established notion that orcs were corrupted forms of elves or corrupted parodies of elves. The suggestion seems to be that as orcs were to elves, so the trolls were to ents. So, you know, instead of taking, you know, these kind of great creatures of wood, they're more stone-like, and certainly the trolls in The Hobbit were indeed turned to stone by sunlight, hence why they always have to have caves nearby into which they can retreat. But by the Third Age, Sauron has made the Olaghai, who are trolls that can go outside in the sunlight, which presumably is the sort of thing we're dealing here. This one specifically is a hill troll. They're described as kind of looking like basically really big men, but with skin that looked like greyish scales. And Arador, son of Argonoy, or to give him his far more common title, Aragorn's granddad, he was actually slain by hill trolls. So the hill troll that starts in play, it is a 30 engagement cost enemy. So your threat is above 30, it's coming for you. It has one threat, 6 attack, 3 defense, and 9 hit points. It has the traits troll, And excess damage dealt by the Hill Troll, that's damage beyond the remaining hit points of the character damaged by its attack, must be assigned as an increase to your threat. So you're starting the game with a threat of 30 or more, and that means you need to be able to defend an attack of 6 turn 1, and you cannot just stick down a Snowborn Scout or some other kind of one hit point defender, because if you do, that's 5 extra threat you're taking each time this guy swings at you. And yeah, I think big, dashy, not particularly intelligent. It seems fairly accurate as a way of kind of capturing the trolls. And this kind of starts a theme for trolls in the game. You'll see this in various other places. You know, some sort of variant on trample damage for troll enemies is quite common. I'm trying to think of some of the examples.
I like the suggestion that there might be trolls with two heads out there.
Yes. There's the Great Cave Troll who removes threat for excess damage. There's the Cave Troll from Khazad Dûm who damages another character. I think we only have one two-headed troll, which is in the Nightmare version of Conflict at the Carrack. I think his name's Robin Bob or something like that.
Yeah.
I do love how all of the trolls, at least like early on, are Cockney.
Yeah. Yeah, they're in The Hobbit, they're very childlike.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't think we get hill trolls in Lord of the Rings. We obviously, as Boromir will tell you, they have a cave troll deep in Moria. But yeah, I think the only time you see trolls certainly in Fellowship, when Frodo's kind of contemplating becoming the world's shortest ring wraith as they try and rush into Rivendell for healing, they do stop, and I can't remember if it's Sam or Pippin saying, look, Mr. Frodo, it's Bilbo's trolls, because they're still there as statues where they had been for the previous 60 years.
Yeah. So does a hill troll require to be out of the sun?
So I think, as I say, that these would be one of the Sauron's Olukhai. So they do appear to be able to go out in the sun. Although the art is, to be honest, I think you've got Force Lightning going on behind the hill troll, but it certainly looks pretty dark.
We know, and I'm sure the answer is no. Is it direct sunlight or is it daybreak? So I only ask because I'm wondering if, say, some malicious force gets a storm to follow them around and there's no sunlight because of cloud cover, would they be all right?
Oh, right, because that's what Sauron does at one point, yeah. Right? He creates a big... Yeah. So it's probably...
From The Hobbit. It says, "Dawn take you all and be stoned to you," said a voice that sounded like William's, but it wasn't. For just at that moment, the light came over the hill. There was a mighty twitter in the branches. William never spoke, for he stood turned to stone as he stopped. And Bert and Tom were stuck like rocks as they looked at him. So that does kind of make it sound like literally the sun came over the hill, and as it hit them, they turned to stone. Because otherwise, you know, if you treat it more like a sort of D&D magic item that recharges at dawn, then you'd imagine even if they went inside a cave, they'd still be turning to stone.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah, it must be more direct sunlight. I mean, because, you know, sunlight bounces off the moon and they're out at night.
So that's the troll. I think he feels quite thematic, and as I say, he definitely feels to me like the defining enemy of the quest.
In that core set, I don't know about you guys, but the two texts that it suggests you take through, I sort of played the most, which is the lore one and the leadership one. If you go into this quest with the leadership deck, at 29 threat immediately. You have one turn to do something about this, or to prepare to do something about this. If you go into it with the lore deck, that's 30 threat and you're engaging this immediately.
Yikes. Yeah.
Like you're hoping that you've got a really good opening hand you can pay for super cheaply, which with that Lore mono deck, I don't think there's anything in there that's going to help you with this, is there?
I mean, I think essentially with that Lore deck, your strategy is kill somebody turn one, put your threat up quite a bit, stick a Forest Snare on it.
Yeah.
Which...
Yeah.
Ah, but you can't do that because you cannot defeat the stage while any hill troll... Oh, but you can still kill it because you can hit
yeah.
it.
Once it's got yeah, forest snare. Yeah. Well, once it's got a Forest Snare on it, you can then take 37 rounds to slowly chip away at it.
Do one damage to him a turn. Yeah. But you have to worry about other enemies, right? Because he's not the only one coming out.
Yeah. So we also have some wargs and a wolf rider. I've lumped these together because they seem very very similar types of creature. And let's go for another chunk from the Hobbit, because it says this is when Bilbo and his dwarven companions have just come out of the mine having slain the great goblin. And just at that moment, the wolves trotted howling into the clearing. All of a sudden, there were hundreds of eyes looking at them. Still, Dory did not let Bilbo down. He waited till he had clambered off his shoulders into the branches, then jumped for the branches himself. Only just in time, a wolf snapped at his cloak as he swung up and nearly got him. In a minute, there was a whole pack of them yelping all round the tree and leaping up at the trunk, with eyes blazing and tongues hanging out. But even the wild wargs, for so the evil wolves over the edge of the wild were named, cannot climb trees. So it's kind of strange because essentially Tolkien seems to be saying here that a warg and a wolf are the same thing. He said a little bit later on in the same section that they have a language. It is very inspiringly known as the dreadful language of the wargs, which Gandalf speaks and Bilbo doesn't. And it's a little bit hard because the Hobbit does kind of lean into talking animals in a way that's a bit more Narnia and a bit less kind of what we think of from the Lord of the Rings. But yeah, this kind of sense of what wargs are, what, you know, are they just wolves? Are they demonic wolves, which I think Tolkien describes them of elsewhere. He describes them as elsewhere in some of his writings. Obviously, Peter Jackson kind of made the wargs look more like hyenas. I think just because he wanted them to look different from just ordinary wolves. But yeah, I'm not really convinced that there's much here to suggest that we should necessarily be thinking of them that differently. There are also a lot of wolves in the First Age, but
yeah,
they're probably not directly linked to these.
Tolkien does this sort of thing a few times. And the wargs are evil wolves from over the edge of the wild, right? And we have... So he sort of has, like, there might be normal wolves that are just very animal-like, and then there's this evil version of them there's more intelligence to them or whatnot. He does it with the eagles, too. There are the great eagles, who are intelligent creatures, and, you know, they work for the Valar. And then there are just some regular eagles, too, who are just birds.
They're cruel.
Yeah, and that we actually have one as an enemy, right? And he sort of does that quite a few times. There are just regular spiders too, right, that make cobwebs in the corner of your house and you gotta knock them down, and they're eating regular flies. And then there are the evil spiders in Mirkwood that are much larger and, you know, spawns of Ungoliant, like we've talked about. So I always kind of associate, and it might just be my own headcanon, you know, if it's a warg, it's been corrupted, or it's evil, or it's a little more intelligent. It could just be a regular wolf, but it's there's something else there.
Sure. I mean, you know, certainly the wargs' enemy there. They're clearly the nasty ones. And it's a 20 engagement cost, so it's probably coming to get you. 2 threat, 3 attack, 1 defense, 3 hit points. So not that chunky, probably fairly easy to kill. Except if wargs is dealt a shadow card with no effect, return wargs to the staging area after it attacks. And again, so many variations on this through the life of the game. We get some kind of warg enemy with, if this was dealt a shadow card with no effect, it does something annoying, and something annoying is often going away. Sometimes it'll be attacking again or something like that. So yeah, you want that, but mild, but not fatal. So we were playing last night and we had one, and it was exhaust a character you control. I was like, great, I've got an Imladris Stargazer here who was just getting ready to scry the deck. I can exhaust that, no problem. I don't need to take another hit. But yeah, that's so annoying. The number of times you're right, yeah, I can kill it this turn, and it's back in the staging area.
Yeah, I picture like the wolves like harrying you, right? Like if they're unencumbered by some trick they're trying to do, they just dart in, bite you, dart out. Like it makes sense to me, though. At least it feels, it feels wolfish.
Yeah,
sort of.
It kind of it puts me in mind of there. Even though you only have the one card, it does feel like maybe there's more than one of them there. Like, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, you never quite know how many's there because they're always just nipping in and nipping back out again and be coming at you from all sides. And
yeah,
and it's nice. And it's similar with the Wolf Rider. And, you know, he's pretty puny. I mean, clearly it's Wolf Rider and Wolf, even though he only has the Goblin and Orc traits. But, you know, he's a one threat, two attack, zero defense, two health. But he surges. He's engaging you on a 10. And most painfully, his shadow is Wolf Rider attacks the defending player. That player may declare a defender, give it its own shadow card, and then stick it back on the deck. So, yeah, it's the kind of pings out of nowhere, attacks you, not very hard, and then disappears before you can kind of deal with it. So yeah, they've got this kind of theme here of, yeah, as you say, they're kind of milling around and they're coming to get you and they're backing off and all this.
I think in this particular quest as well, it's also really nice because these are definitely, they don't suffer from the whole thing we were talking about earlier, where it's like, how are these things following us as we're going down the river? You know, wargs are clearly going to be able to keep up. They're not necessarily going to be encumbered by lots of tritus that there might be around a riverbank. You know, they're a lot faster. They could be keeping up with the raft easily, and you can just see them there stalking you as you're traveling down the Anduin.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. Absolutely.
Like that, it's the kind of thing that even if you weren't, like, delivering this message, you could imagine if you were just traveling down the Anduin on a raft for general reason of getting from A to B on your daily commute, you might look over and just suddenly see a warg like going along and be like, oh no, I think I'll just stay on the raft a little bit longer.
Yeah.
So what else have we got stalking us along the banks,
well,
James?
I mean, the thing to bear in mind is that it's not always the banks. You know, threat can come from the land, but it can also come from the air. And again, I feel this is just such a signature enemy of the early game, but this is the first time you meet the Eastern Crows. They are a one threat, one attack, zero defense, one hit point enemy, surge, and after it's defeated, shuffle it back into the encounter deck. So they are coming again and again and again, unless you're questing with Thalin. It's strange because, honestly, in a pre-Dane, pre-Tactics Theoden world, why are you questing with Thalin? He has one willpower. Well, you're questing with Thalin purely to kill the Eastern Crows. In terms of crows, the main thing you need to know is that crows are not to be confused with ravens. Ravens are the good guys. Ravens are particularly helpful in The Hobbit, you know, sending messages, forces of good in the run-up to the Battle of the Five Armies. I think they give recognizes Balin because Balin was an old friend of his dad's and, you know, helps him out a bit. But the crows are the bad guys. Probably most famously, we know that Saruman uses Crabine, who are basically big crows. He uses them as spies in The Lord of the Rings. That's kind of one of the reasons the Fellowship are kind of forced to change their route because of the risk of being spied on from afar by Saruman. They look pretty sinister, and there's a heck of a lot of them. I mean, to be honest, if you look at how many of them there are on the cards, one hit point is pretty impressive that they're so easily scared off. But yeah, I guess it's maybe you hit one and that one's dead and the flock scatters, and then next round they're back again because you didn't kill them, you just scared them away for 2-3 minutes. So and again, I think there's a few of these in the deck. I think is it two or three three copies. So yeah, when you get down towards the end, unless they're coming out as a shadow, you've got kind of three of these in the last half dozen or so cards just being shuffled round and round and round again. So yeah, that can be a lot of crows.
And it's a pretty mean shadow effect as well. Like, you might actually just want to see them as a recurring card, although the surge is pretty nasty.
Yeah, because you could potentially have all three of them surging into each other and then still get your normal cards. I mean, plus one attack, plus two if your threat's 35 or higher. Again, you know, we've already mentioned that this quest is basically a tutorial on how to manage your threat. I think you've probably got some cards that relate to that coming up in a minute. It's below 35, one attack's fine.
On a theme point, you brought up how Saruman uses the Cribane or these large crows as spies. And I was just thinking, he mocks Radagast as Radagast the Bird Tamer. And yet here he is using birds as spies that he's clearly tamed. I mean, he has a Palantir, so he doesn't need birds to spy for him, right? He could just look in his crystal ball and see where Gandalf is. But here he is using birds after mocking Radagast about it, which we see him. He mocks Gandalf about the halfling leaf, and then he's importing it to Isengard. Like, he's real petty. And
He definitely projects onto the other Astari, doesn't he?
Yeah.
But yeah, no, again, I think thematically these guys work well, because like they're barely attacking you, and you know they're not hard to, you know, an individual crow is really easy to kill. Yeah, they just don't really go away. You know, it's almost like a swarm of midges. You know, you bat them away, and then they just keep coming back. I think it works.
Yeah.
There are a few other. A few other enemies in this, which are either kind of recurring. Quite a few of the orcs are figures we've seen already in the previous quests. One orc I found particularly interesting was Chieftain Ufthak, who, as I say, he was in Passage Through Mirkwood. It crops up again here, but the one point where Ufthak is actually mentioned in the books, he was an orc at the Tower of Cirith Ungol, and he got stunned by Shelob and kind of strung up in her lair, and Shagrat, who was his commander, just thought that was funny and kind of left him there rather than rescuing him in that delightful orcish way. So quite what he's doing halfway up the Anduin, it did puzzle me a bit.
We got to remember the timeline, right? So this is we're playing before Lord of the Rings. So if he's a chieftain here, we see him in Mirkwood, we see him in Anduin, we see him in the Escape from Dol Guldur, right? He's going to be an orc there. He must work out of Dol Guldur and be of some notoriety. And then by the time Shagrat encounters him in Lord of the Rings, they call him Old Ufthak. So he survives for quite a while before maybe retiring to Cirith Ungol. Or, you know, being the old guy there who's maybe a trick training the young guys or whatever. It's neat that they pull this guy out of that book and we get to see him here. I think that's kind of cool.
Yeah, I'm now imagining him in Lord of the Rings, kind of like Tom Cruise in the new Top Gun film. You know, this is him in his glory days, and then, you know, that's him. That's him training the young hotshots.
I wonder what retirement age is for an orc.
Yeah, how many orcs make it to retirement age?
I know, but it's got to be set, you know, like, one of them's going to get there eventually.
I mean, I think it probably depends on how effective the trade unions are in Mordor at that particular point in time. If you don't understand that, you don't need to listen to more Critical Encounters.
Well, that's right. Go back to an issue in April, the beginning of the month.
11th, wasn't it?
It was. It definitely was. I mean, if we go by the lore that orcs are corrupted elves and elves are immortal, are orcs immortal? They just never quite make it that way because of their lifestyle, right?
I mean,
would they have a retirement age? A couple hundred years? A thousand years? You know, Ufthak could have been around for centuries. We don't even know.
No, it's just interesting to think, isn't it? Because, you know, there is the whole corrupted elves thing. They're nowhere near, not the opposite. No, I feel like if men can fight orcs and they can win, I feel like men and elves would be an unfair fight.
So I'm going to toot my horn here a little bit. If you go, you guys remember Master of Lore? He used to have a very prolific blog back in the day for this game.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so if you go back onto his page, December of 2017, I did a whole article on like the origin of orcs and the possibility of their age and different things based on what I could find. I think it's a good read. It was a fun write. So if you go back and check that article, you might be able to kind of start thinking about retirement age or how old are they, that sort of thing. So
yeah, so probably the last one we'll take a look at here is the Goblin Sniper. Again, I think this epitomizes for me the spite of goblins and orcs. So this guy just sits up in the staging area. He's got an engagement cost of 48, 2 threat, 2 attack, no defense, 2 hit points. During the encounter phase, players cannot optionally engage the Goblin Sniper if there are other enemies in the staging area. And if you're engaging him non-optionally, then you've got problems because your threat is 48 or 49. Forced, if Goblin Sniper's in the staging area at the end of the combat phase, each player deals 1 point of damage to one character he controls. If you get 2 of them, they're both staying there for the rest of the game unless you have some kind of trick for dealing with it. Now again, like the wargs, some of this does seem like it's just a bit of an advert for Dune here. Anything that lets you target the staging area, because it's a fairly miserable experience to play Gandalf and decide that the thing you're going to do with Gandalf's center play is take out a Goblin Sniper. But sometimes it just has to be done. I know where we're trying to focus on Tolkien's writings here, but I do always remember there's a bit in the in Peter Jackson's Fellowship of the Ring where, you know, the Balrog is charging, the bridge is collapsing, everyone's fleeing. As all of this is going on, there's just some goblins way off in the background just firing arrows at them, because why not? Like, everyone's all, you know, they're all probably dying anyway, but just for fun, let's just poke them with more arrows. it feels very on brand for goblins. Like, yeah, in a straight fight, almost any hero's just going to take this thing out with one punch. But yeah, they're just kind of staying out of reach, staying out of sight, and just sniping.
So what do you think the theme is behind that, not being able to engage them if there's other enemies? Do you think it's because they're so far out the way that you'd have to, you know, get past those other enemies to get to them?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he's clearly on the branch of a tree, so you know, if he's up the tree and you want to just go and wring his neck, but there's a pack of wolves at the bottom of the tree, you need to deal with the pack of wolves before you can start climbing after the goblin.
Yeah, I think he's fairly cowardly too. He's hiding behind the other guys on purpose, right? He knows he can't take you in a fair fight, so he's putting other people between you and him.
I do think that this is a bit of a dirty trick in this scenario. Like, yeah, you know, we're being trained, like James has said a couple of times, to keep our threat low, and let's just say you've got some threat reduction, so you've managed to keep your threat below 30 for like the whole thing and deal with the hill troll on your terms. Get to stage 3, flip over those 2 encounter cards, and you're at maybe low 30s threat, and then you reveal 2 of these.
Yeah. You can't
because they
right?
just sit there and chip away. Unless...
And if you have no way to do some direct damage, and there are 2 of them, even if you make it to stage 3, you can only win if you kill everything off, but you can't actually ever engage them. You're eventually just
going to die. Your only
option
is if you have enough allies in your deck that you're drawing and able to play enough of them, you could allocate 2 damage per round and just wait until your threat ticks up to 48.
Right.
And then make sure you kill them that round because, yeah. Well, I guess, yeah, you've got 2 rounds, but still.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, though, I think the enemies here are pretty good thematically. You know, it's not a some of the later quests, you've got a very, very thematic, you know, everything in this is a type X, but it is very much like you've got orcs and goblins, you've got wargs, and you know, we know that the wolves and the orcs team up. Yeah, we've got the crows. There's a random adder. I couldn't find anything relevant on snakes, which is why we've not really talked about that much. And you got the great big troll. So,
can I ask you about that?
Yeah, I mean, we have this marsh adder who raises your threat when he attacks you. There's just really not that much. I mean, even if you look at the flavor text on the marsh adder, it says, you know, under the boughs of Mirkwood there was deadly strife of elves and men and fell beasts. I mean, personally, fell beast always makes me think of the things that the Nazgul ride when they're flying, but Tolkien does kind of use it. He uses it both specifically for those things, but also just kind of generally for and other bad creatures. But yeah, I wasn't able to find any point at which Tolkien specifically talks about a massive snake. It's also kind of confusing that his first age dragons are called worms with a Y, and lots of them crawl and don't fly, but this is clearly something more person scale, I think.
So, I know this is going off of this quest a bit, but am I right in remembering that some of the later Mirkwood quests that use this card have got extra large snakes and adder style enemies in with them?
So there's the Muck Adder, which appears in Blackadder the Third, in Conflict of the Carrack. Which, again, that has if it damages a character, that character is discarded. You're going to attack. It's only a 2, but yeah, it can take things out. But I think most of the other snakes are a fair bit later. There's one in the Long Dark.
Okay.
One in Ninian Elf, Escape from Khazad Dûm. So yeah, that's certainly it for adders. I'm trying to think if there are any other snakes. Yeah,
I mean, this thing has 7 health.
It's chunky.
And it attacks for 4. It's no,
no hill troll.
Yeah, but I think you're right. It's got to be one of these fell beasts with the lowercase f, right? It's just another one of these things like warg/wolf. It's an animal that is ferocious and, you know, savage because of its corruption, maybe from its proximity of living in Mirkwood, that kind of thing. So,
and as we covered at the start when we're talking about the timeline, it's basically been 2,000 years at this point since Greenwood has kind of fallen into shadow and been called Mirkwood. I don't know. I think often I kind of forget that and think of it more as this is something that's happened in, you know, not very recently, but like when the White Councilor meeting in The Hobbit. And, you know, it feels more like a sort of, or you know, Greenwood starting to turn back in starting to turn into Mirkwood. It's been like that for 1500 years or more. So yeah, the fact that the nature's been corrupted. Well, no, not the, definitely not the films.
Yeah, don't use the timeline from the Hobbit movies.
I'm now just remembering myself shouting at the screen at the end of Battle of the Five Armies when Thranduil tells Legolas to go and find this young Dúnedain ranger. It's like, he's 6!
Yeah. All right, well, that's most of the enemies are the ones we're going to talk about. There are more than just locations and enemies.
There are,
right, Simon?
There are treacheries. And slight spoiler here, I find a lot of them disappointing. So it's very similar to the issue that we have with Passage Through Mirkwood. Treacheries in this feel very sort of generic, and I kind of alluded to it earlier. They feel very much like they are included because they're part of the encounter set. So I'm going to start with the first one that really, really does make me think that, and then I'm going to work through to the my favorite and most thematic feeling one of them all. So we're going to start off looking at despair, which you might think, despair, yep, we're probably feeling some despair, and we probably are. But it's just, when revealed, remove 4 progress tokens from the current quest card. If there are fewer than 4 progress tokens on the quest, remove all progress tokens from that quest. And I don't know, maybe I look at the card art and take it a little bit too literally sometimes. But it appears that we've got this essentially a hobbit, probably Bilbo, kind of wading through the muck and the mire in the woods, presumably in Mirkwood. And I don't know, it doesn't scream Anduin River to me. So I don't know what you guys think. The remove 4 progress tokens from the current quest card, it does feel like we're despairing, like we're lost, like we don't know where we're going. It doesn't scream something that necessarily fits in the quest from a lore perspective.
Well, I mean, so one thing I will say, I didn't mention this enemy because they're kind of vanilla, but the one enemy that's actually in the encounter set with the picture of the Anduin River on are the Misty Mountain Goblins, whose effect is after they attack, remove a progress from the current quest. Shadow, remove a progress from the quest. 3 progress if it's undefended. So it's almost like they're building a theme. But then you look, and even though these are in the same quest, they're in 2 different encounter sets. So, it feels a little bit like it's, as we said, it's just we're creating a toolbox of generic effects because we're going to use these in all of the upcoming quests. I think it's particularly odd with this quest because I think possibly this and Passage Through Mirkwood are the only quests in the game which don't have a unique set. So even the Anduin River set with that picture on, which is like the one that's on the quest card and is the sort of the title set, it still gets reused a lot in Mirkwood. You don't have any, other than the quest cards, you don't have any cards that are just this set. I think, as you say, the treacherous seem to be kind of feeding into that.
I think in Tolkien's work, the concept of despair is fairly significant. So it's nice they have a card for despair, but I agree with like everything else you said, right? Feeling odd in this quest.
It could even be something like, I know this would get into too much specifics and require it to be part of a encounter set for a quest that was only used in that quest. But if it was something like, if you're on the Anduin, if you're on stage 2 of the quest, then this card just surges. Because you're on the Anduin, at that point you're kind of safe.
Yeah, you're not paddling back upstream.
Yeah, exactly. You're not lost. You know where you are. So you don't remove that progress. But if you're at stage 1 or stage 3, where you're up on the banks, where you're either, swamped with enemies, or you're finding your way through whilst also having to fight Hill Troll, I think that would definitely hit a lot more.
Yeah, this card does nothing on stage 3, because you're not putting progress tokens on the quest card. Or you are, but it doesn't matter, right?
Yeah. Yep, that's a very good point. So we'll move on to something that feels a little more thematic towards the quest that we're doing. And it's probably worth mentioning them together. I'll mention them together and then we'll go into each separate card. It's Evil Storm and Treacherous Fog. And I think both of these are quite nice. Again, a little generic, but they're nice in that they give you that sense of constant malicious presence that's kind of there, possibly manipulating things and making your travels that little bit more difficult. So first of all, we've got Evil Storm, and when revealed, you deal 1 damage to each character controlled by each player with a threat of 35 or higher. So again, it's feeding into that theme of high threat bad, low threat good, as if your threat's below 35, it's kind of, this whiffs.
Right.
I think this fits very nicely into a river journey and journeys along around wet places. A storm comes in, you're on the bank of a river, you're not going to be able to get dry. You're not going to feel, you're going to start hurting, trench foot.
And I think it
holds.
Yeah, you don't want to be on the water with lightning, that sort of thing.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think kind of brings out that theme you have in Tolkien that bad weather can be supernatural. It is caused by maliciousness, the actions of the enemy. It's not just that was unfortunate timing. It's there is a dark will causing this storm or this fog or whatever it is.
Exactly. And again, I think that idea of the evil storm comes if your threat is 35 or higher as well. It's like whatever you've done has been enough for you to be noticed. And as a result of you being noticed, this evil presence is sending this storm into where you are.
It's no coincidence that the storm's happening.
Yeah, yeah. Like, you've done something, you've been noticed, and now you're going to get wet and maybe struck by lightning. Who knows? Mechanically, one damage to each character is not something to like be taken lightly either. It's like a conditional necromancer's reach. It affects everyone rather than just resting characters or exhausted characters.
In the set with the non-conditional necromancer's reach. So you can have both in the same turn.
Exactly. When you reveal those two cards and you've quested with everyone and your threat's over 35 and then everyone takes two damage.
And then you scoop and you set the quest up and you start again.
Yeah, that's tough.
Yeah, exactly. I think that it's a nice reminder as well that these early quests, if you get the wrong cards come out, it could still be really difficult. So next up we have Treacherous Fog, which again, it feels like the weather is being controlled, I would say. You know, it's each location in the staging area gets +1 threat until the end of the phase. And then each player with a threat of 35 or higher chooses and discards one card from his hand. So again, it's that, you know, you have done enough stuff. This malicious weather is coming in. And obviously fog makes it harder to find where you're going. So it makes perfect sense that you've got that +1 threat to all of those locations. You're there kind of scrabbling around in the fog, quite desperately trying to find your way, losing things out of your bag as you go. Maybe losing people.
Yeah, I mean, it's,
you know, you just,
it's simple, but yeah, it's very effective as, yeah, there is fog, hard to find way, more places there are, more of a problem fog is.
Exactly. Then we have Pursued by Shadow. I do like this one. I particularly like the imagery on it. We've got a Nazgul riding a fell beast with a capital F. And when revealed, each player raises his threat by 1 for each character he controls that is not currently committed to a quest. Yeah. So this is kind of like the opposite of the Necromancer's Reach. I know we've got threat there instead of damage, but this is kind of like you've got that option of they could maybe not quest with everybody because Necromancer's Reach might come out. And then the offhand of I should quest with everybody in case Pursued by Shadow comes out.
Yeah, you think, well, it's fine. I don't want to worry about Necromancer's Reach, so I'll just quest with Eowyn and Aragorn with Calibrian Stone. You know, that's fine. They're doing 8 or 9 between them. Hold all the allies back. Oh, my threat just went up by 10.
Yeah.
Here come the trolls!
Yeah, I like the theme, too. Like, if you're not on the move, if you're not actively questing, you know, trying to go where you need to go,
yeah,
they're going to find you. And that's bad. You can't sit still in one place for too long or else this Nazgul that's looking for you will find you.
Yeah. Again, it does a little bit. When we get to stage 2, it kind of has the opposite problem. When you get to stage 2, it feels kind of weird because even if you were trying to, you know, put all of your all into getting down this river, you're still on a river. If that Nazgul flies over, it doesn't matter if you see it coming or not. You're in the middle of a river. You can't hide from it. But generally, I think this is...
Because you have that phalanx of Gondorian spearmen that you've collected on your boat. He can't figure out how many of you there are, so he can't count that high. It's like, I don't know how many there are. Whatever. We're okay.
Yeah. I'm going to move this on now to... this is my favorite. I think it's the most thematic, and it's the only treachery in... the journey along the Anduin set. It's massing at night. So it's when revealed, reveal X additional cards from the encounter deck. X is the number of players in the game. And I mean, for me, this really feels like it fits with the quest. It fits with the Anduin. It's probably helped by the art. You know, we've got what I presume to be Boromir, Aragorn, Legolas, Gimli. You know, it throws back to Lord of the Rings, where they're traveling along the Anduin, and these ambushes keep happening. And yeah, it works for me. It works so well.
Yeah, that art really lets you know.
If you're in a four-player game, having four additional cards come out.
Whereas in a solo game, the only thing this really does is make you think, well, there was no point in exhausting Henemarth River Song to look at the top card of the encounter deck.
I still think even in a solo game, if that extra card that you reveal is a Hill Troll...
But what I'm saying, this card by itself hasn't done anything. So in a solo game, it just says Surge and no effect.
Yeah, that's true.
You're getting hard having a card that in itself did nothing. Yeah. As you say, in four player, horrific, but a solo, it's just...
Yeah. I still think... I mean, I mostly play in solo, and I see this card, and I still think that fits here. I mean, like you say, in solo, you're right, it does just say Surge. But I don't know if it's just the way that it's... It could be worse, so I still imagine it being worse than just a card that says Surge.
Well, the shadow effect for it is brutal, too. Deal X shadow cards to this attacker, X is the number of players in the game.
Yeah, an extra, yeah.
Four. In a solo game, it triggers the warg, so it will go back to the staging area, even though it didn't do anything. But man, if you end up with four shadow cards on something, and you were expecting one, that's
so with
that's
the warg, they could still go back to the staging area. Because if they get dealt this... It's not when, if the wargs are dealt no shadow cards with no effects, it's if the wargs are dealt a shadow card with no effects. So if you dealt them this and then card with no effect on it came out, they'd still go back to the staging area.
So yeah, if you're being attacked by a warg in a four-player game,
oh, you're right.
Get four extra shadow cards, you could potentially have three absolutely disgusting shadow effects and one location with no shadow, and as well as having to suffer the three disgusting effects, the wargs would still clear off back to the staging area.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
What if those three disgusting effects were Wolf Rider? which come out? Oh, that's a great combo.
You've got your villain hat on now for this, haven't you?
I do, I definitely do, yeah. Well, it really feels like those wolves and wargs are massing at night.
Yeah, exactly.
Here they come.
It's great. So. It's really, really good. Love it. So the set does, as I mentioned, it also has Necromancer's Reach in there, which is, you know, we spoke about it a bit before. It's not the nicest effect. But I'm going to move on. I'm not going to mention all of the nightmare cards.
Good.
I just want to mention Pursuit on the Shore.
I thought you were just going to stop there. I'm not going to mention all of the nightmare cards.
No, so I'm going to mention Pursuit on the Shore only because it's disgusting. So Pursuit on the Shore has the effect of when revealed, search the victory display and encounter discard pile for the enemy with the most hit points. Return that enemy to the staging area. And if no enemy is returned by this effect, Pursuit on the Shore gains Surge, cannot be cancelled. So there's two of these in the Nightmare deck, and you really want to see both of these before you kill the Hill Troll.
Yeah, holy moly.
So that's, yeah, you're almost guaranteed, unless it comes out really early on, to be getting a Hill Troll back when this comes out. Worst case scenario, again, I think I look at the worst case scenario so much because of how British I am, but the worst case scenario is that you kill a Hill Troll whilst you've got two of them out and you're still on stage one, and then this comes out, pulls the other Hill Troll back, so you've got two of them again, you still can complete stage one, so you kill another one, and then the second copy of this comes out and pulls the Hill Troll back again, so you have to kill... Would that be four or five Hill Trolls before?
That'd be four.
Before you can even get through.
And if you're playing in Nightmare, you've also got three copies of the Troll Spawn, who just engages the player who's engaged with the Hill Troll. It's a nice four attack, three defense, five health Troll to go with it. And once all that's happened, you can then pull the Troll Attack Treachery. When revealed, all engaged Troll enemies attack. Oh. Yeah, the Nightmare set for this is pretty disgusting.
Your best case scenario for this Pursuit on the Shore is you have both Hill Trolls in a forest snare, because then you're going and you're getting some other enemy because the trolls are not in the victory display or the discard pile, right? Or they're still in the deck.
somehow. Your best case scenario for this is that it comes out and you get one in your first turn and one in your second turn, and you haven't killed the hill troll yet. So they both just sit in your discard pile.
Best case scenario is you get it as a shadow card because it has no shadow effect.
All that, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the Marsha Edder has a 7 health, and so if the trolls are out already, it can fetch one of those.
If the trolls are out, you think you've killed the Marsh Adder? Because, I mean, I'm going for the trolls first.
Yeah, I'm just trying to, like, look at...
I don't think there are any at this point.
Fluff? Oh. Holy moly.
It's not nice.
The art on it, well, not the best art, does have that feel, though, of those wolves or wargs charging down the riverbank at you. Like,
yeah, I do love how the art is of the wargs, and you're probably never going to use this card to pull a warg back. Like,
right. Yeah. To help.
What are the chances?
I mean, I guess if you have a 4-player game and both trolls and the Marsh Adder and something else, and they're all already in play.
Impossible.
You haven't killed anything else? Yeah.
Again, it could be that, like, your first turn, the encounter card, you get to warg, the trolls out, you kill the warg, this comes out, So it's possible, It's not unheard of.
Yeah. Well, that's quest 2, right? We've talked some of the history, the quests, the locations, enemies, treacheries. Do we have any wrap-up we want to talk about with, like, the story that we're being told or that we're including? Anything we haven't said?
I mean, much something we haven't said, because I think we've kind of touched on this a lot. But yeah, I think this quest does a very good job of taking some very generic encounter sets and using literally just those 3 quest cards to tell a very distinct story. And aside from some slight oddities like disappearing off to the East Bight on the far side word, it actually feels quite coherent. I think, just those 3 quest cards, you feel like a troll, you're getting on the raft, you're going down the river, you're coming ashore into a great big fight. It does that remarkably well, given that there isn't really any kind of unifying theme in the enemies or the treacheries that you're facing.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that. I think the storytelling in this, like you say, just from the quest cards, it's hard to miss the theme. It's hard to miss the point.
Yeah, this is going to be your second quest that you're playing as a new player. You've done Mirkwood, which everybody knows, and now you've done Anduin, which everybody should also know. I think it works for making you feel like it's Middle Earth. You know, even with the generic treacheries and things like that, it's all stuff that's familiar. And like you said, the story's cohesive. You know, you're going down the river. There's a weird oddity, like you said, East Bight, that kind of thing. But that's easily ignored or not even noticed as you're worried about everything else.
I mean, if we talk about mechanics just for a little bit, there is one thing. Like, this has some very confusing things on the quest cards mechanically, I think, for the second quest. I think if you're a new player coming into this, especially if you didn't have a resource that you could go and look at, or like a Facebook group that you can go and ask the question, or a Discord where you can chat with people.
I don't think Discord existed, did it, in 2008? Or 9, whenever it was? I can't, whatever.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, sorry.
It's the whole, you know, one additional card. That's fine, that makes sense. Do not make engagement checks during the encounter phase. I think that's the point where it starts to get a little bit... I know it's trying to introduce mechanics and the ways that the game will give you quests. To have that and then to have another quest afterwards where you skip the staging step of the quest phase. I definitely played this wrong the first time and possibly even the second time that I played this quest.
I think it's quite good because... I know, you know, back when we used to play this a lot with some friends who were fairly casual, you know, like they'd never read the rules, they'd never built decks. It was very much that they turned up at my house, I handed them decks, we played the game. And I'm sure we basically went, okay, we've done travel, right, now it's the combat phase, so we'll just stick all of the enemies engaged with our player And if it's got a threat that's higher than anybody's threat, we can leave it behind, but the others will just instead of going, actually, no, right, there are distinct steps. There is optional engagement. Okay. You can only optionally engage one enemy. Then you're doing your engagement checks. You know, again, kind of the whole thing for the questing phase, right? You know, okay, well, what is the questing phase, right? You've got committing characters and responses. Then you've got the staging step. Then you've got an action window. Then you've got resolution. So I think it's actually quite good for kind of making people go back to the rule book, which, you know, which was in the box, and say, right, let's, you know, it's just actually break down the steps and don't kind of rush to the point where you kind of blur whole phases or even multiple phases together. Again, you know, I think there was probably a while when we were playing with those people who play quite casually where kind of the refresh phase and the resource phase of the next round all kind of blur into one. So I think, you know, if you're actually wanting to play the game properly, then starting to push a bit on these kind of things is probably good, I would say.
Rule book. That's where I was going wrong.
Yeah. The rule book. Yeah. I do like too is the first Mirkwood quest is here's the very basic outline. We're going to tell the simple story. You can have the same sort of game. Like, we're going to follow the steps in the rulebook, pretty basic. And then on the second quest, look what we can do with this game. Look at the story we can tell. We're going to change up all the rules right off the bat. I think that was nice to see that, like, oh, there's more to this. They can do a lot with this game other than just quest, travel, fight. Like, everything is going to be so fluid, they're going to be able to make these neat stories, and I think they did a pretty good job. But yeah, Simon's right. If you're not paying attention to the cards or reading it, you're going to get it wrong again because they do change it up so quick on you after playing that first scenario.
I think that's what it is. I think for me, it was just the fact that you've got those two very distinct rules changes within the one quest, one after the other, and maybe it's playing solo as well, so I didn't necessarily have someone there who I could be like,
check you. Yeah.
Yep. This is right, isn't it? Yep. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And when it first came out, like you said, there was no Discord or whatnot. You asked on a forum and you waited. So please somebody get back to me, you know, within a week. Still favorite quest. I think because of the story, because of the mechanics. Do you guys play this even today?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. It's still a decent quest to test a deck against because, yeah, you've got to have control of your threat. You've got to have an answer for a big enemy. You've got to be able to quest. You know, if you're playing solo, you've got to be able to put out a good chunk of questing even when the deck's throwing a lot of cards at you. So, yeah, whilst the individual enemies and locations are control aside, a lot smaller than things you see later. It's still kind of a decent sort of first test for does this deck function?
A lot of that comes down to that hill troll as well, doesn't it? Like you said, you need a deck that can deal with that immediately. And I think if you've got a deck that can deal with something that big immediately, it's probably going to be a reasonable deck for a lot of quests.
Yeah, when this first came out, you had the core set, and that was it. Now new players have the core set. They have the pre-constructed decks. Maybe, you know, they can get all sorts of cards for it. So progression originally, it could be tough. It could be really difficult. So
I think when I first played this, I was just really hoping to be able to sneak attack Gandalf twice in a row.
Or even sneak him once and hardcast in the next round. Still six.
That requires having more resources than I would have probably had at that point in time.
Next, that would be six. One for the sneak attack, save your other two. Three more in upkeep.
Oh, good point, yeah. But it's not impossible. But you've got nothing else then. You've got something else in the staging area as well that you're having to deal with.
Yeah. Well, if you're really lucky, you're playing true solo, the Hill Troll's the card you reveal in setup. Your threat's nice and low. You draw the treachery that's just take a damage if your threat's over 35. Quest sufficiently to ignore it first round. Sneak attack it with Gandalf. Planning stage two. Play Gandalf. Hill Troll's dead. Questing with all your heroes plus Gandalf against an empty staging area. Bish bash bosh. Done.
Perfect.
And in what world has that ever actually happened?
I mean, if you gave an infinite number of monkeys an infinite number of copies of Lord of the Rings, the card game, then eventually...
it still wouldn't happen.
Well, guys, this has been fun. I think that is a good spot to end on. The infinite monkeys.
Yeah, definitely.
Thanks for doing this with me, having me on for this again.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for coming back.
In another 6 months' time, we'll...
I look forward to doing it again when we'll look at quite possibly the...
The standard FFG co-op LCG Quest 3, a.k.a. You Need More Player Cards.
Yeah.
Buy them now from your friendly local shop.
Oh, well, we'll get to that when we get to that.
Yep.
Now, I'll just go and get beaten up by a Nazgul.
Excellent. Well, thanks everyone for tuning in tonight. I'm assuming that if you're listening to this episode, you know how to find the Card Game Cooperative. But if you don't, if you go on most social media type places and look for the Card Game Cooperative, you'll find us. Steve, if people would like to hear more of you, where can they find you when you're not moonlighting in Middle Earth?
Yeah, you can find me, Daniel and Mike. We do the Critical Encounters podcast. It's all about the villains and the modular sets for the Marvel Champions LCG. So you can find us by searching for Critical Encounters podcast on all your various social medias and find us that way.
Thank you for joining us, everybody. And we'll see you again next time.
Strider, take us out.
It is a fair tale, but it's sad. As are all the tales of Middle-earth, and yet it may lift up your hearts.